is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And during the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. It conducts innovative research and programs in health and nutrition, and it provides consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and by foundation grants. It accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. In the July segment of Nutrition News, I focused on diabetes and ways in which we can use proper nutrition to lower our risk of developing the disease. I'll continue that discussion now by focusing on ways in which we can use strength training and aerobic exercise to lower the risk of diabetes further. Overeating is not the only cause of diabetes. Aging also increases the risk, even if you are lean. But you can counter some of the consequences of aging with strength training and aerobic exercise. Here's what makes us more vulnerable to diabetes as we get older, and how exercise can help. One of the most commonly observed changes that contributes to diabetes risk is a decline in muscle mass that starts after the age of 30, explains Brenda Davey, Associate Professor of Nutrition at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. Davey recently reviewed the impact of aging and exercise on diabetes. Less muscle may raise the risk of diabetes because muscle is where the body sends most of its sugar, blood sugar, that is glucose, to be burned or stored. Less muscle also means a lower metabolic rate. That is, you burn fewer calories even while you're resting. With resistance training, you can increase muscle, explains Dr. Davey. By increasing your muscle tissue, you are increasing the amount of tissue that can use glucose. Aerobic exercise does not build as much muscle as resistance exercise. And that's one of the benefits of strength training. The more muscle, the better, says Sherry Kohlberg, who chaired a committee that issued a joint statement on exercise and type 2 diabetes from the American College of Sports Medicine and the American Diabetes Association. As you age, you not only lose muscle, you also gain fat, especially the deep visceral fat that is linked to diabetes. Strength training can help by shrinking your waistline. And we're not talking about strength training that targets only abdominal muscles. We use a whole body training program, not a spot reduction approach, says Dr. Davey. It's not that we target the abdominal area with exercises. It's just that fat in the abdominal area is the first to go. When it comes to burning fat, The abdominal adipose tissue depot is particularly sensitive, explains Dr. Davy. So it is easier to lose fat from there than from other fat storage depots in the body. Please note that she did not say it would be easy, just easier. What's more, adds Dr. Davy, you may have reductions in abdominal fat even when you don't necessarily observe large changes in total body fat. But strength training is not the only way to lose body fat. Recovery from exercise is fueled primarily by fat. So the real benefit for fat loss is burning as many calories as you can doing any type of physical activity, explains Dr. Kohlberg, who is a professor of human movement sciences at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. Now, insulin resistance increases with age, but it is not clear why. There's some problem with insulin signaling inside the cell, says Dr. Davy. For example, there are fewer glucose transporters to bring glucose into the cell. Both aerobic and resistance exercise can rev up the transporters. If you work out today for at least a day or two afterwards, you will have heightened insulin action, says Dr. Kohlberg. What's more, exercise can get around insulin resistance. Muscle contraction causes muscle cells to take up glucose, even without insulin, notes Dr. Davy. That is one reason why aerobic or resistance exercise is particularly beneficial for individuals with diabetes. Even if you are insulin resistant, you can still reduce blood glucose levels. Both strength training and aerobic exercise have benefits, says Dr. Davy. Aerobic exercise may be more likely to produce weight loss because you can expend more calories, she notes. But older people who have arthritis or who use a walker may prefer strength training. Some may find a resistance training program more appealing than aerobics, says Dr. Davy. Clearly, doing both is best. When researchers assigned 262 people with diabetes to aerobic exercise, resistance training, both or neither for 9 months, only those who did both lowered their long-term blood sugar levels. In people with diabetes, the combination has a clear benefit, says Dr. Davy. I would not want to say that one is superior. How much strength training is enough? Shoot for 8 to 12 repetitions of 8 to 10 exercises at moderate intensity 2 to 3 times a week. You can only do strength training effectively every other day because you are actually damaging the muscle and it takes a couple of days for it to repair itself, says Dr. Kohlberg. And try for at least a half hour of brisk walking or other aerobic exercise at least 5 days a week. That helps, but there is a limited amount of time and a limited number of calories you're going to expend in 30 minutes or even in 60 minutes, notes Dr. Kohlberg. What helps the most is being active all day long. Get up and walk around. Get a treadmill in your office. Don't sit at the computer all day. In a special feature published in the June 2011 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter, senior nutritionist David Chart provides information concerning comparative nutrition. In Who Knew, Is This Better Than That?, he presents evidence that may help you with some decisions with which you may have struggled. Decisions, decisions. What we eat often comes down to weighing whether A is better than B, fried or baked, butter or margarine, white meat or dark, organic or conventional, name brand or generic. In some cases, the answers are no-brainers. In other cases, not so much. So here's a little help with a few you may have wrestled with. Is krill oil better than regular fish oil? Krill oil is a slam dunk winner over fish oil, claims Joseph Mercola's popular website, Mercola.com, where, not surprisingly, you can buy krill oil. Bayer, which owns One A Day, apparently agrees. The supplement giant dove into the market this year with its Arctic Wonder krill oil, quote, better than fish oil to support your health. Krill are shrimp-like crustaceans that occupy a spot near the bottom of the Antarctic Ocean's food chain. They are eaten by whales, seals, penguins, squid, and fish. Krill oil, like all fish oil, contains EPA and DHA, the two omega-3 fats that help prevent sudden cardiac arrest. There is some evidence that maybe 20 or 30% more EPA and DHA is absorbed from krill oil than from regular fish oil, says omega-3 expert William Harris of the University of South Dakota's Sanford School of Medicine. But it's not that much more to warrant krill oil's much greater cost. The DHA and the EPA in krill oil cost at least 10 times more than the omega-3s in regular fish oil, which typically comes from menhaden, sardines, and herring. Claims that krill oil can lower cholesterol, reduce symptoms of PMS, premenstrual syndrome, and relieve the discomfort of arthritis are based on studies funded by a Canadian manufacturer, Neptune Krill Oil. But krill oil lowered cholesterol only in combination with a statin drug. And for those not taking a statin-like drug, krill oil was no better than a placebo. And no one else has tested the effects of krill oil on premenstrual syndrome and arthritis. There's certainly no convincing evidence that the health benefits of krill oil are superior to those of regular fish oil, says Dr. Harris. Is calcium citrate better than calcium carbonate? There is a difference between calcium supplements, claims the CitraCal website. It goes on to say CitraCal is made with calcium citrate, and unlike calcium carbonate, the main ingredient in many other calcium supplements, calcium citrate does not need stomach acid to be broken down. That is true. So, if you typically take calcium on an empty stomach, citrate is the way to go. But if you take your calcium supplement with a meal, there is no significant difference between calcium carbonate and calcium citrate pills, notes Robert Recker, director of the Osteoporosis Research Center at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. That is true even for people who take drugs for acid reflux, like Tagamet or Prilosec, which reduce stomach acid. What's more, calcium carbonate is cheaper and less bulky. To get the same amount of calcium, you need to take twice as much citrate as carbonate. A recent analysis of past studies suggested that taking calcium supplements is linked to a slight increase in the risk of heart attacks. Until more is known, shoot for no more than the recommended dietary allowance, 1,000 milligrams a day, from food and supplements, combined, for women 50 and under, and men age 70 and under, and shoot for 1,200 milligrams a day for people older than that. And there's no point in taking more than 500 milligrams of calcium at a time, since the intestinal tract cannot efficiently absorb more than that in a single dose, says Dr. Recker. Is eating earlier in the day better than eating late? Weight Watchers in the Atkins and South Beach diets have all told dieters to limit the food that they eat at night. For generations, people have believed that food eaten when they are less physically active is more likely to be stored as fat than burned for energy. But that is not based on hard evidence. When researchers tracked the eating habits and the body weights of more than 7,400 U.S. men and women for 10 years, for example, the percentage of their daily calories that they ate after 5 p.m. had no bearing on changes in their weight. I know of no credible evidence that the time of day has any impact on the storage of fat, concludes Albert Stunkard, an obesity expert at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia. On the other hand, if you eat extra calories because you are tired or bored or stressed, and nighttime is when you are more likely to do that, expect those calories to eventually show up around your waist. Is canned light tuna better than albacore tuna? Light tuna typically has much less mercury than white or albacore tuna. That's because albacore tuna is a larger, more predatory species than skipjack tuna, which is canned as light tuna. In January, Consumer Reports magazine analyzed 42 cans and pouches of tuna purchased in the New York metropolitan area. The light tuna samples averaged 0.07 parts per million of mercury. The albacore or white tuna averaged 0.43 parts per million of mercury. That is 6 times as much. And these results are consistent with past surveys of canned tuna from other cities. Young children, as well as women who are pregnant or nursing, or who might become pregnant within a year, should limit canned albacore tuna to no more than 1.5 ounces a week for every 50 pounds that they weigh. And they should limit canned light tuna to a total of no more than 12 ounces a week. Others can probably safely consume up to 3 times that much of each type of tuna. So if you are willing to spend more, you can find albacore with mercury levels much closer to those of light tuna, says Michael Morrissey, director of the Oregon State University Seafood Laboratory in Corvallis. That tuna comes from smaller, juvenile Pacific albacore that are trawled caught in the coastal waters of Northern California. Oregon and Washington State. The juveniles, which haven't had as much time to accumulate mercury as larger albacore, average about 0.14 parts per million of mercury. Northern Pacific pole or trollcot albacore is one of just six best of the best species on the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Super Green List. Green List species are low in mercury and PCBs, rich in omega-3s, and abundant, well-managed, and caught or farmed in environmentally friendly ways. The other five species are wild-caught Alaska salmon, farmed rainbow trout, wild-caught Pacific sardines, farmed oysters, and freshwater coho salmon farmed in inland tank systems in the United States. Several brands of canned Northern Pacific albacore, including Raincoast and Wild Planet, are available at some groceries, direct from the companies, or on Amazon. Are lycopene pills better than tomatoes? Tomatoes and prostate cancer have been linked since 1995, when Harvard researchers reported that among the nearly 48,000 men in their health professionals' follow-up study, those who ate at least 10 servings of tomatoes, including tomato sauce, a week, were one-third less likely to be diagnosed with prostate cancer than those who ate fewer than 1.5 servings a week. Since then, however, most studies that tracked the eating habits of large groups of men for years have seen no link between prostate cancer and either tomatoes or lycopene, the major carotenoid in tomatoes. Ideally, researchers would feed men tomatoes or give them lycopene for a placebo and wait to see how many in each group get prostate cancer. But that kind of study is expensive and difficult to pull off, so it isn't likely to be done. We do have impressive animal studies, though, says lycopene researcher John Erdman of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. In one of those studies, rats exposed to a prostate cancer-causing chemical who consumed a diet containing finely ground dried whole tomatoes were 26% less likely to die of prostate cancer than rats who got lycopene or a placebo. And when Erdman and his research group transplanted prostate tumors into rats, the tumors grew more slowly in those rats given tomato powder, but not in those rats given lycopene. So it looks like you may need an array of bioactive ingredients that you find in the whole tomato, says Dr. Erdman. Lycopene is one of the important components, but it is not the only one. Of course, rats are not people. Eating tomatoes may or may not protect men from prostate cancer, concedes Dr. Erdman. Still, they're a nourishing food. As for lycopene pills, it does not make sense for men to take them in place of eating tomatoes. To absorb the most carotenoids from tomatoes, eat them cooked, says Dr. Erdman. Or, if they are in a salad, make sure the dressing or the rest of your meal contains at least 10 grams, that is 2 teaspoons, of fat. Calcium supplements may raise the risk of heart attacks, says a new study published in the British Medical Journal. But the results are baffling and no cause for panic. The Women's Health Initiative was a randomized clinical trial that gave roughly 36,000 postmenopausal women calcium at 1,000 milligrams plus vitamin D at 400 international units, or a placebo every day for 7 years. Since the women did not know if they were in the calcium group or the placebo group, the researchers allowed those who were taking calcium when they entered the study to continue it on their own, and roughly half did. Among women who were not taking calcium on their own, those who were given calcium had a 16% higher risk of heart attack or revascularization, angioplasty, or coronary bypass surgery than those who were given a placebo. Surprisingly, among women who were taking calcium on their own, those who were given calcium had no higher risk than those who got a placebo. In fact, they had a 16% lower risk of dying during the trial. These women were getting the most calcium, that is, an average of 800 milligrams a day from their food, 580 milligrams a day from their personal supplements, and 1,000 milligrams from the researchers. It is hard to understand how extra calcium could raise the risk of heart attacks, given that the women in the study who took the most calcium had no increased risk. It is also hard to see how calcium supplements could cause a small increase in the risk of a heart attack and a small decrease in the risk of dying. However, to play it safe, aim for the recommended dietary allowance for calcium, but no more. The recommended dietary allowance is 1,000 milligrams a day from food and supplements combined for women up to age 50 and for men up to the age of 70, and 1,200 milligrams a day for people older than that. The new analysis does not prove that calcium promotes heart disease, but it does raise that possibility, says Bess Dawson Hughes of the Tufts University in Boston. As with all nutrients, enough is enough, and the current recommended dietary allowance defines enough. Well, folks, we have reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News. This show will be rebroadcast this week on Friday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 3 p.m. Please join me for the next edition of Nutrition News, which will air on Wednesday, September 7th. I'm Ann Weller, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I hope that you have enjoyed the show. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience, and it is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. See you next month.